weeks ago, if I would just talk about some of the ways of meditation and how they're talked about in our texts. So I'll give that a go. But first, a nice story. I've spoken about this chap before. There's a postman, our postman, called Matthew. And I was once in the lobby of the block of flats that I was staying with my mum. And this postie came in. It was autumn. It was cold. And he had shorts on. And he was putting the post in the box. I was sitting there, and I said, "Are you from New Zealand?" Because all the posties in New Zealand, they wear shorts all the time. And he said, "Actually, I lived a year in New Zealand." So we got to talking, and we got quite friendly, and he delivered packages up. And one day he knocked on the door of the flat and said, "Do you teach meditation?" Because I kind of talked about my life a bit with him and where I lived in New Zealand. I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can you teach me?" I said, "Well, maybe." So I directed him to a website, so several websites where there were some good meditations and so on. And then he saw the website for our monastery, and he got the blurb on me and all that. Amazing, the internet, isn't it? And the man said, yesterday, knocked on the door. He said, "Hey," he's a diver. He teaches diving. It's his main love, is diving. The postman is to make some money. And he's into competitive diving. I don't know what that is, but it's something about holding your breath underwater. So the reason he asked me about this meditation was quite practical, because he wanted to increase his time underwater. So he came yesterday, knocked on the door, and said, "Hey, listen, I won." And he'd gone to this website and did a little shopping of which meditation technique he'd like. And he took up metta practice, which is "May I be well, may others be well." And he used that in the diving. And he said he held his breath for 5.5 minutes or something underwater, which is pretty good. I said, "Wow, he used metta for that." And I said, "Well, how did that work?" He said, "Well, it just kept me focused. And it's a nice thing to do." I mean, he enjoyed it. It's a really sweet meditation. And he said it kept him focused, which meant kept him cool, which means he could stay underwater longer. Nice one, huh? Wow, great, nice feedback. So in meditation, what we keep in mind is that one of the basic things of Buddhist practice is awareness, huh? Mindfulness, awareness, presence, being here now, these different ways we talk about it. So whatever meditation you pick up, whatever meditation technique you use, one wants to, first of all, be able to collect one's mind, collect one's attention. So that's the opposite of being scatterbrained, right? Kind of bring it all together. One wants to somehow be able to sustain that collected mind and perhaps also focus it. So these kinds of ideas about collectedness. So you see in the texts a lot this idea of being recollecting or collecting the mind. You see, any topic you take, really, if you're taking it quite deliberately and you're focusing on it, be it some body work or some kind of conceptual thing or a mantra, that actually that would, you know, would work, wouldn't it? It would collect your mind. Your mind wouldn't be scattered. Your mind would want to maybe be scattered, but as you collected it, that would be one of the factors. So that's quite simple. Just to learn to collect the mind. So you don't have to sit cross-legged to do that. Right? You can, like if you're feeling really, really busy, you know, you've been doing a lot of stuff, and you know, you're just on one of those rolls where you get really restless and you can't stop. Just sit in a chair and watch yourself want to do something else. Just do that for 5 minutes. You know, well, I should change the flowers, or do the dishes, or, you know, just you can just watch that for 5 minutes, and that's meditation. Because you're not, one isn't just following that impulse of, when we get into those runs, don't we, where we've done 100 things, so we just kind of get on that run, where you just stop and just sit in a chair and watch that, observe that. and then not do it for 5 minutes, just that. And that brings a sense of collectedness. Okay? So that's a major part of what meditation is about. So one could see that if I did meditation for half an hour on any theme, then that ability and that way of being collected is increased in the mind. The ability to do that is increased in the mind. The skillfulness to do that is increased in the mind. Even if during the half hour you thought you're all over the shop, you think about this and oh gosh, I can't meditate. But actually, just staying in a posture for half an hour, taking a theme and trying to be with it, even if it's just watching your restless mind, has a kind of powerful effect on consciousness, because it develops the skill and it collects the attention more. And the results of that might not be kind of immediate in the sitting. You might have thought, God, I barely knew I was there. One of those kind of sittings that we get. But actually, just that collectedness is very, very skillful. Very skillful. So that's sustained collectedness, isn't it? You sustain that ability to be here now. Focus is the ability to stay with one topic. So the typical one is to take the breath, isn't it? And you can refine the focus from the whole breath to one aspect of the breath, like at the nose or at the mouth, and get very, very refined concentration. Some people don't like that. They don't like that kind of... I don't like myself. It's just my personality, which I've watched over the years. I don't like tight focus. I like space. I like openness a lot. So if I use the breath, I use the whole breath. I use the whole breath body. I don't focus down on one thing. So my focus, I don't concentrate on fine focus as much as openness. That's something that I've learned. So what you find in developing meditation is you kind of discover things where kind of the way you like to do it. And you have to be quite creative. You can't just... Well, maybe you can. Matthew did it. You can't just read a book and do it. But you find as you evolve, you find that we all are different characters, and there's some kinds of meditations we like and some we don't like. Just kind of, it's a matter of temperament. So a lot of what one learns is just through doing things and trying things. But typically, focus is very important. You find a lot of meditation in Theravada Buddhism talks about very refined focus. So they talk about jhana practices where you take like the feeling at the breath and really, really refine it down and be very, very focused and very absorbed. So some teachers will talk about that. I don't talk about that because I don't do that much. So you get a lot of teaching around that very, very refined focus. So you have collectedness, sustaining collectedness, and the possibilities of focus. Now, if you look at Buddhist schools of meditation, there's a vast array of stuff out there on meditation techniques. They take the simplest Zen practices of Soto Zen, which is one of the schools of Zen. They call it Shikantaza, or just sitting. That's ultimate simplicity. Just sitting. You just take the posture and just know. That's it. So that's Soto Zen. And then you take maybe some things in Tibetan Buddhism, really complex visualizations, very complex conceptualizations, and maybe even with 1,000 prostrations thrown in. Yet very, very complex things. So that's one thing you might consider is the issue between complexity and simplicity. Like a simple practice of just what we in Theravada would call choiceless awareness, or bare attention, or just watching, or just knowing, has the difficulty is that your mind can wander, right? So you're just knowing, and then the bell rings, and you're just kind of going off. So I think the use of complexity in meditation techniques is to keep you preoccupied, basically. So if you have a very complex mantra or visualization you're doing, or metta practice. If you read about, say, some of the classic practices of loving kindness in Theravada Buddhism. You know, they have these very, very worked out, like they have, you take five different types of people, and you have a complex set of phrases about the five types of people, and then you take all men, and then you take all women, and you take, you know, you develop a very, very complex structure of thought to develop metta meditation. And you can see that the usefulness of that would be that you'd have to stay with jaw. Couldn't want, you didn't have a second break here. So that would kind of keep you on the jaw. But what I find with many practitioners is that there's a kind of, many people go from a kind of complex things to more simple things. As their minds become more more able just to enter into still attention or still knowing. So the complexity is very, very helpful to get you grounded, but it can become just too much work. You know, oh gosh, you got to pump out all these phrases all the time. Or it can be very concentrated. So that you'll find in the various types of techniques, that are complex or very, very simple. So in Theravada Buddhism, what I practice, and I mean, I love to read, you know, things by the Dalai Lama, his suggestions, and I like to read Thomas Merton, and you know, I'm kind of a real omnivore of meditation techniques. So, but I do have some kind of basic things which I like to really do a lot. But in Theravada Buddhism, you have 40 kind of classic meditation themes that are written about. And so I talk about some of those, all 40, and you'll throw your cushions at me. You get completely lost. But one I'd like to just think about is how you, like a lot of a Buddhist meditation encourages us to really cultivate positive states of mind. Now, in Buddhism, I'm reading this book on His Holiness the Dalai Lama and his group of scientists, and one of the things they keep coming across is that in Buddhism you don't really have a word for emotion. It's kind of the most basic kind of word in Western psychology. What Buddhism tends to use is more things like afflictive mental states or constructive or wholesome mental states. So they talk more about wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful. And within that, certainly, you have emotions, but they're defined specifically as anger or fear or whatever. So in Buddhism, there's a tremendous emphasis on really understanding what is skillful and unskillful in the mind. What are skillful states of mind and unskillful states of mind? What are deluding states of mind? What are wise states of mind? What are greedy states of mind? And what are altruistic states of mind? So there's a lot of emphasis on understanding that, first of all, in consciousness, and then developing the wholesome ones, the positive ones. There's a lot of training around that. So one of the ways to look at meditation is that it is a training of the heart and mind. And training, I think, is a good word to use rather than getting. If you put the word training into your, at least I find, if I put that into my practice, then if I'm like feeling dull or I'm feeling restless or whatever, okay, this is what I'm training with. Rather than, I'm not meditating well, I'm not getting that result that I wanted. I take what's given. Okay, this is what's given today. I feel dull or restless or whatever it is. And I say, okay, this is what I'm going to train with now. And that's quite helpful, I find, because it puts into perspective what I'm doing now. I've got this particular consciousness which I want to work with, and then I figure out how to work with it. As opposed to trying to get something. That's the deadliest thing in meditation. If you try to get something, you just feel so frustrated. Because every now and then you get it. And then you're... So this... Before, what was very important for me is to see this movement forward into time. This kind of... That's why I like to talk... My visualization of it is it's a very vertical practice as opposed to a horizontal practice. Horizontal practice is always like going there and getting it. And vertical practice is very here now, present. That's the imagery in my mind. So even if I'm watching the breath or something, I'm trying to get something from it, that's already tension. If I don't put any effort forth, then that just kind of wanders. So it's like being present, but in a very, very, very present way, not trying to get anything. So that's an attitude behind it. But in developing the positive states of mind, there are some very classic reflections, which are perhaps cultural. They're very Buddhist. So if you're not a Buddhist, perhaps they don't ring a bell. But what they're pointing to probably should. So the first reflection is reflection on recollection of the Buddha. If you're not a Buddhist, then maybe that doesn't kind of strike a chord of devotion. But what it's doing there is you recollect the life of the Buddha, like the renunciation of the Buddha, the power of his meditation, the profundity of his renunciation, what he really gave up, the power of his meditation. The guy got enlightened. He did it. Whatever that is, that he taught for 45 years, that his teaching, the analytical powers of this man are phenomenal. When you look at the power of analysis he has on the mind, and one just like, you know, you hear the Dalai Lama talking to these scientists, they can't keep up to him. His understanding of the mind is just so, I mean, the Dalai Lama's analysis is powerful too. And then you think of the Buddha. So all these kind of factors, as one contemplates them, one gets this real rush of devotion and optimism. I think that's my kind of word on this, is kind of a spiritual optimism, that there is a goal, that human beings can realize that goal, that there was a being who was generous enough to teach this, and that there are other beings. He's not the only character, you know, there's other beings around, but that there, you know, that there is this kind of potential we have as human beings, and there was this being who did that. And all of that kind of reflection is very wholesome. So we call that bhutanusati, or recollection of the qualities of a Buddha. And I often talk about this, I take other saints, you know, I take saints from other traditions who have really inspired me, and I use their pictures, and I do all that, because that really brings me that sense of upliftment. So there's a kind of ability we have to bring the mind to the sense of religious aspiration, of all those qualities which these beings kind of bring out in us. And this is very important, because so much of life can, you know, we're just watching BBC News this evening, oh, so depressing. Me and my mom are looking, why do we do this? Why do we do this to ourselves, right? And the only good part was the business news, because that we didn't understand. But anyway, that's it. But so you can, you know, the kind of information in society can be kind of negative. So we need to, I think, bring into the heart this kind of spiritual upliftment. And these kinds of reflections, like reflection on the Buddha or whatever, are meant to do that. So you can, like, reflect on that in your own life. Well, how do you bring forth that sense of aspiration? You know, through your own readings or whatever. This is very, very wholesome, very skillful. Recollection of the Dharma is another kind of meditation, when you recollect the teaching. The Dharma is the truth of the way things are. One very simple way is that there is truth. You know, there is the law of karma. There is a sense to this whole seeming confusion of life. You know, that there is direction in intellect. That there is wisdom. These kinds of things. Recollection of the Sangha is that there are spiritual, there are beings who do the work, who have attained, and who are committed and who practice. So you have spiritual community. So this we call the triple gem: Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And they're very traditional meditations where you reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities of the Dhamma, and the qualities of the Sangha, which we actually chant. And if one's going to do that, one tries to make that somehow realistic in the heart, you know, rather than just parroting it. So like the recollection of the Sangha, I'll often go through my peers or my teachers, the monks and nuns at the monasteries I've practiced at, Ajahn Chah, and I just bring them to mind and kind of recollect their practice and their dedication. And all this is to bring forth, you know, really, really wholesome states of mind, skillful states of mind. And it needn't be like for 45 minutes, just like doing something like that when you begin practice brings that optimism into the mind. Recollection of virtue. There's one. This is like you kind of recollect your virtue CV. Because what the text says, like you recollect your good deeds, you recollect your moral precepts. So that presumes that one's keeping moral precepts. You know, if one is robbing banks, then that recollection isn't going to make me too happy. So the idea is that Buddhism is based upon a very wholesome lifestyle, but then you actually recollect that. And then sometimes we don't do that. You know, we live good lifestyles the best we can. And then we just recollect that maybe, you know, we got angry at Loblaws because someone poked us or something, and, oh, I'm terrible, I got angry at Loblaws. But actually, you know, we don't even recollect, well, I'm actually trying to keep the precepts. I'm trying to be faithful in relationship. I'm trying not to kill. You know, I actually let that mosquito bite me, or whatever it is. And that kind of recollection of wholesomeness, recollection of one's own goodness, is I think, very important for minds which are hyper-self-critical. And we can't, you know, our culture can be that. You need self-criticism to you know, evolve, but if it's just kind of this hyper-self-aversion, that's not it. So again, it's like bringing forth the goodness of one's own mind. So, like, the Asians are very good at this, who actually have that whole framework, you know, of Theravada Buddhism, where they go to temple, they take the five precepts, and they rejoice at keeping the five precepts best they can. We don't have that kind of culture. And it's not kind of self-congratulatory, egotistical. You know, it's not that. Look at me, I'm keeping the precepts. Or I got more precepts than you. But it's something a bit more profound than that. It's something, what is it? It's about valuing the goodness of your life, isn't it? And valuing something good in you. Recollection of generosity, dana. This is one. You know, like just, I've been doing this with mom, because sometimes I think, oh, I'm not doing anything. I'm just cooking and making bed. But I actually do it. Then I look at her and say, actually, you're doing something very important. So I keep looking and saying, you're doing something important, because I have to do that to balance this mind of mine, which thinks I should be writing books or building monasteries, or, you know, because it seems so ordinary to. But actually, you know, it is important, isn't it? So I have to keep. So I just think this is generous, not as a kind of conceited thing, but to bring forth that sense that this is a good thing to do, this is a generous activity. You know, making a cup of tea is not unimportant. So then I really try to make a cup of tea with an act of generosity. I had a very good result. If I just kind of get the cup of tea over to mom so that I can, you know, do something else, what else they do, then of course it has none of that beautiful quality of generosity in it. So like recollecting generosity, because we are, you know, most people, I mean, incredibly generous. You know, really, really, very generous. And sometimes we don't recollect that in little ways. Again, it's not egotistical. It's just recollecting one wholesome karma. So these kinds of recollections about Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, virtue, generosity are sort of a foundation that you find in many classical traditional Buddhist practices. They kind of say, go through that pattern. You can see if you do that, and it doesn't have to be that long, it actually sets up the mind in a very wholesome, positive way. So then the kind of the sort of techniques that you find, body work, there's a lot of that, and I think for me, breath meditation or awareness of the body has been incredibly helpful for just getting out of my head. Because when I went to the monastery, I was just such a headpiece. It's just always in thoughts. It's just hopeless. You know, just always just thinking and analyzing and figuring and self-criticizing, blah, 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 always that. And just kind of just bringing the attention down into the body, again and again and again. Through work, through craft, through breath meditation, through yoga, those kinds of things are very, very, very wholesome, very skillful. Because we live in intellectual cultures, don't we? You know, we use our head, we use our intellect a lot to analyze, to think, to write, which is fine. So all the meditations like that to get into the body are very important. So breath meditation, that's talked a lot about. And breath meditation is just so many variables, from things like pranayama in yoga, which are very kind of energizing, powerful things that you can use, to just the subtlety of watching very, very refined breath. So with breath meditation, I think it's one of the best ways to look at emotions. And now I'm speaking in a kind of Western psychology way. All the emotions that we experience as human beings, again, and I talk about this so often, but if we take the emotions into thought, we don't really know them. We tend to just think them. You know what I mean? Huh? So there's a difference between me being angry and thinking angry thoughts and actually getting to know anger in the body. So that the ability then to get to know one's emotional world in the body is a very, very it pays big dividends. I'm sewing myself some shirts right now. My shirts are wearing out. I've got the sewing machine. Right? You know sewing machines. Or do you know sewing machines? So you know, I do about a run and then underneath, it all gets caught up. You know, that drives you nuts and sewing. So, but I've done so much body meditation on, say, anger and so on. As soon as you just feel my body, it's not the sewing machine's fault. Don't take this personally. And just watching how, you know, years of practice on the body, as the body starts to get tense with this delightful machine. And just so always, as the more you practice with things like aversion, that just kind of clicks in all the time. You notice the breath whatever you're doing. There's a kind of, like I say, a second level of consciousness. But if one has never done that, if one's never trained to look at emotions in a different way than just thought, if one has always kind of just sort of either judged them as being wrong, I shouldn't feel this way, or just followed them, those two extremes of both indulgence and repression, then the skillfulness of looking at emotions through the body isn't there, so one has to develop it. And that's done just through, like, when you feel, if you're feeling angry or fearful or whatever, try to get onto the zafu, get onto your cushion, and investigate the feeling of emotions in the breath, in the body. Right? Best time to meditate, when you feel rotten. Because if you've got the space, I mean, you might need a babysitter or whatever, if you've got the space to do that, then where else can you learn about emotions than right there? So as you're feeling irritated or excited or whatever, you look at that, feel that. Then you become familiar and your body begins to have an intelligence around the emotional world in the body. Very, very helpful, very skillful. In this book, the Ajahn Dalai Lama, I almost said, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, says it's like developing an immune system for your psyche. There's a nice way to put it, because we're all going to get angry. You know, there's maybe 1% somewhere in this planet who don't, but most of us, you know, we're going to get, these things are going to get triggered. He says it's like developing a good immune system. So if you cultivate these things in those spaces of your life where, you know, where life is too pressured or whatever, then you do have a kind of a foundation for freedom, even when they do arise, even when they do come into consciousness. But if one's never done any kind of work like that, then one's just a victim to circumstance. So you feel, well, everything's okay, and then things fall apart, and you know, the heart just kind of explodes in its old habits. So, but not to see, like, not to think that you should only meditate when you feel, you know, happy or something. To actually meditate with those feelings of fear or anxiety, whatever, anger, is very, very useful, very, very helpful. And to do it as an inquiry into those moods. You know? So the breath, the body, the breath as the energizer. So like deep breathing, breath is energized, the breath is calmer, how to calm your breath. Breath is just health, to make your breath deeper, rather than just kind of little shallow kind of chest breath, to make it deeper, really bring a lot of air. There's so much there, you know, breath is very, very valuable. So reading about like pranayama or getting a good yoga teacher and really getting working with the breath in yoga or Qigong or, you know, these things really getting, there's so much good things around the breath, very, very much to develop there. So those kinds of meditations are very good for like getting centered and so on, and the working with emotions. The heart practices of what we call the Brahma Viharas are the practices to really would take you to counterbalance the whole alienating part of our life, of fear and anger and that. So these are very deliberate meditations to bring forth open heart feelings. So they're like, it's pretty hard to do metta or loving kindness pretty practice when you're angry, isn't it? So some people think there's sort of some substitute. So I feel angry and then I love you, you're lovely. But it doesn't work that way. You're just angry. Right? But if you've done loving kindness practices for 5 years and you're getting angry, then that clicks in. You see a bit of contrast. So they're not just some kind of repressive measure, you know, just some kind of simplistic repression of anger. It just wouldn't work. Because when you feel angry, the best thing to do is say, wow, this is anger. May I be free from anger? You know, just something like that. And then eventually you might, you know, get around to liking the other guy. But you have to be authentic first. So when in those situations where you can, to develop, you know, really sincere heart practices. So I've got a nice one now. I go bird watching now early in the morning, before anyone's in the park. Very nice time. Very nice. And I found a nesting kestrel. And I saw a common loon on Dow's Lake. That was a treat. But anyway, I come back, and my mum lives on this pretty posh street called Kippua Drive. And there's these posh houses with these posh cars. Everyone has at least one, is it SUVs, huh? And usually two cars. And you know, they're all kind of well-to-do, polite Canadian people. And I do a practice of called mudita. I walk along and I say, may you be well. May your stocks go up. I really do. May your kids be successful. May you enjoy your wealth. May you be well and happy. So I reflect, well, you know, they've done something good to get all this. And may they get more. Now that goes against maybe my ecology mind, which says, oh, these SUVs, they're polluting the atmosphere, and what are we going to do and all that? But I'm not there to criticize them. I'm there to rejoice at their goodness. Yeah? So I'm not taking a position about, you know, about SUVs or anything like that. But it's just like to rejoice at their goodness. And that's one of the heart practices that we have. It's called mudita, where you bring up the success of someone else, and you say, may they enjoy their success, may their success increase, may they enjoy their good health, and so on and so forth. It's the opposite of jealousy. It opens the heart. Now, we get that feeling a lot with kids, don't we? You know, when kids do something beautiful and they're successful, you know, just your heart really opens very, very naturally towards that. Or like, you know, Victoria getting, or Vancouver getting the Olympic bid. You know, way, great. So there is this kind of open-hearted feeling we have the success of others. And what we actually try to do is we try to really work on that, increase that. Now that gives you a kind of, it helps your immune system towards jealousy and pettiness and just that kind of sour grapes stuff we have in our minds. You know, when we see success, we think, oh, it's polluting the atmosphere, all these cars. You know, maybe it is, but why think about it all the time? It's hard enough breathing the pollution. You know, why pollute your mind? So that's not, you know, that's not sort of condoning whatever ecological positions we might take, but it's just seeing that there is something in the heart which can rejoice at the goodness of others and encouraging that. Now that's very important because sometimes the practices of compassion go to depression. So not only do we have the rejoicing at the goodness of others, we also have the compassion for the suffering of others. So, you know, watching BBC News and what, I think, appalling things going on in Africa. You know, just breaking my heart. And I can see I can very easily go into anger or depression or whatever. But so, like, doing compassion practices is also important. Because they are the immunity to cruelty. You know, that which is cruel in me, you know. And obviously I'm not going to be cruel towards someone who is down or out, but cruelty can arise in my mind, in whatever way it can be. So those are the compassion practices. You know, all beings who suffer, may they be free from suffering. And it's not that I'm going to solve the problems in Africa. Now, the thing about compassion practices, if you dwell on them too much, you can get depressed. Or you can get angry, whatever. So one has to learn how to do other things too. So there's the rejoicing practices. Then there are the practices of just friendliness. Just that, like, I don't like to suffer. I don't like to feel loneliness. I don't like painful knees. You know, I don't like poison ivy, infections. Yeah? I like to be loved. I enjoy good things. So do you. You know, we're the same that way. So it's the metta practice, we call it metta, is the commonality of our human predicament, of our animal predicament. I remember Ajahn Sumedho had a lovely, he was teaching a retreat in Switzerland, and there was a, it was a springtime in Emmental, and Uchis, and the cows were, had just finished calving, and the calves had been separated from their mothers. And the mothers in one field, woo, woo, and the calves are in the other, woo. And Ajahn Sumedho reflected, said, that's what all mothers feel when they're separated from their young ones. And it's a beautiful reflection, because it brought up the commonality of that, of the pain of that. It wasn't just a cow, it's just cows, you know, they're separated from their little ones, they'll be all right. It was a really kind of empathy with the predicament of these animals. And that's what a lot of our practices are doing. So the empathy of our common ground, that you and I are brothers in sickness, you know, sisters and brothers in old age, sickness and death. That's our common ground. As a practice of metta, as a practice of friendliness. Which is the kind of helping the immune system to, which is that which is always criticizing. You know, you moved during meditation, I saw you, or you were falling asleep, or, you know, whatever comes up in the mind. And the critical faculty is fine, but if the critical faculty is not balanced with that which is our common ground, the critical faculty turns on us and destroys our relationships. It just finds fault all the time, doesn't it? Without the critical faculty, we're naive. So we need the critical faculty. It's just part of good, you know, it's good equipment if we use it well. And then equanimity. And these are what we call the four Brahmaviharas, and they're very important practices in the heart. Equanimity is actually interesting in this book. Ajahn Dalai Lama, there you go again. His Holiness the Dalai Lama said that they begin with equanimity, which you could see how an equanimity is a reflection, and this is sometimes hard for non-Buddhists or Western Buddhists to take, that all beings are the with birth there is old age, sickness and death. So all beings are owners of karma. You know, that we inherit things, we don't know where they've come from. And that sense of karma, like sometimes people like in the law of karma, we say that all intentional action has a karmic result. So there's a moral law. But not all things that come to us are a result of karma. So we don't know. You know, but we do know that when we act in certain ways, we get certain results. So like the Tibetans will, they're able to say that the reason they're having all these problems is because of some karmic past event. Most Westerners can't do that. Because it sounds like punishment to us, I think. I think if we take our Judeo-Christian background, that seems too much like punishment. Whereas in Buddhism, and say sort of the Tibetans can rationalize that, say it's cause and effect. It's just the natural result of those kinds of activities. Whatever way you look at it, equanimity is the ability to accept things as they are. Now, how do you get to that? Maybe if you don't have an ability to accept the law of karma as it's presented in Buddhism, then you can't even accept, say, that there are past lives or future lives. And I'm not saying you have to, right? And we have our own kind of culture upbringing. Equanimity is an important part of the heart. Because if we can't accept the way things are, we keep falling into anger or depression or whatever. So what the heart practices in Buddhism are, they're saying that accept the way things are, but also function from compassion, function from joy. You know, these are important. So it's not like a complacency, it's not fatalism, it's not that. And these four practices of the heart, kindness, compassion, rejoicing, and equanimity, are a package. You know, you can't just do like rejoicing, can you? Because that wouldn't be realistic. And you can't just do compassion, because you could just get, if you're always thinking about the suffering of others. And so equanimity is the ability to accept, well, this is the way it is now. So I'm not saying you have to take the law of karma on board, but you have to somehow get to a sense of acceptance. This is the way life is. So the way that's reflected upon is that sometimes it's just reflected upon quite simply, with birth there is this. So the Buddhists say, well, why did he get sick? He was born. That's the sort of medical diagnosis. It's not going to get much cures. But it's not, you know, it's not meant for medical cures, it's meant for spiritual cures, I suppose. Huh? So, but it's not, you know, equanimity isn't dismissive, because that also has compassion. So that's kind of the simplest ways I find that Westerners come to a sense of acceptance. Well, samsara is this way. It's a schlamassel. Or, with birth there is sickness. With birth there is old age, sickness, and death. With birth there is ignorance, and there's confusion, and so on. This is part of the package. You know, with birth there, whatever. Not to take you into pessimism, but somehow to bring yourself to a sense of acceptance. So it's something you have to contemplate, I suppose. And when I can't accept something like injustice, or whatever, mothers will say to their kids, well, who said it was just? Yeah, but it's not just. The law of karma says it's just, but we can't see. We can't see where it's just. So we say that the karmic actions ripen either right now, in this life, or in future lives. And if you don't have a vision of that, future lives or past lives, then that might be difficult. So these four are to get the heart in balance, to get the heart really in balance. And they really undermine fear and anger and aversion and jealousy and all those alienating feelings we have. They really undermine them and bring one to a sense of unity with other beings. A bit more. Just to give you the whole package. Now, you have a whole range of practices around renunciation. And renunciation practices deal with the mindset which is either caught up in trivial pursuits, or is very, very greedy, is very acquisitive, driven to kind of some kind of future acquisition of things, very greedy, obsessed with sexuality or sensuality, aesthetes maybe, who are just obsessed with the right cup of coffee, or, you know, all these kinds of mind states which are very sensual, I suppose. Huh? Not that sensuality is wrong, and it's fine to enjoy a cold cappuccino or whatever, but it's the mind which feels that the whole point of life is a cold cappuccino. It has no spiritual dimension, right? And there the reflections are around death and the limitations of the sense world. So it's not a negation of the sense world, it's a limitation of the sense world. So, and then classically when that arises, when someone dies in the family, you know, someone has been, you know, kind of in some kind of obsessed mode of acquisition or whatever, and someone dies in the family, a kid dies, maybe a child dies in the family, all of a sudden, wow, you know, the whole project of materialism is undermined profoundly. someone's dead now, what's the point of it? What's the point of my Philofax and all my important investments when I've lost that which is most important in my life? And that can be profoundly spiritual experience, or just can take one into deep depression. From deep depression you can have a profoundly spiritual experience. So it's a kind of awakening call. You know, what is the point of life? And so there are these meditations in Buddhism around death, around dead bodies, around decaying corpses. And I've talked about those before. And you look at those in Theravada Buddhism and think, ooh, this is foul stuff, isn't it? Decaying body, it is foul. I've seen some. And the point of that is to really challenge the mind, which is very lustful, or again, very quick. But what's interesting about the Buddhist attitude to the sense world is that the sense world can be used to bring calm to the mind. Because you can look at still water and make the mind very calm, right? But it's how you use the sense world. If the sense world is just used for pleasure, then these renunciant practices are done. So renunciation is like, it's a basic insight that the spiritual life cannot be simply the pursuit of pleasure. I mean, it's kind of basic stuff, right? And that usually comes through some kind of awakening to the limitations of pleasure. Not that pleasure is wrong, it's just limited. Right? If the sense world is just used for pleasure, then these renunciant practices are done. So renunciation is like, it's a basic insight that the spiritual life cannot be simply the pursuit of pleasure. I mean, it's kind of basic stuff, right? And that usually comes through some kind of awakening to the limitations of pleasure. Not that pleasure is wrong, it's just limited. Right? So all the renunciant practices are kind of pointing to that. And they're called asubha. Asubha means not beautiful. And we do this all the time. When we are, you know, when we're thinking about acquiring something very, very, you know, which we think we really need, then our mind says, yeah, but that's going to cost a lot. Or, yeah, I've got 5 already. Or, yeah, but I don't even have any more room in the flat to put this thing. So there's the greed mind, right? The greed mind is thinking, I want that, I want that, I want that. And there's the renunciant man says, you've got it already. You've got 10 of those already. And you don't really need that. And, you know, there's a kind of struggle with the greed mind. And that's what renunciation is about. It's that mind, it's that part of our mind which knows, you know, it's too much. You don't need that. And Buddhism just emphasizes that by, you know, focusing on things like death. And death is it's a shocker. It really kind of, you know, if you've been to hospice or you know, funerals or so, and when you look at a dead body, at least me, I really dwell on that. It says, with birth there is death. And then, of course, the Buddhist reflection, there is the deathless. That was the whole point of the reflection on death, is there is something which isn't born and doesn't die. And then hopefully that piques one's curiosity. And one goes for it, in whatever way one can. So there's a whole kind of range of renunciant practices. And finally, just to finish off, there's the whole practices around inquiry. Right? So these practices of like heart practices, the breath practice, renunciant practices are kind of creating balances. So if one's very alienated from life with greed and with fear and anger and that, one does heart practices. If one is just kind of very much into pleasure, one does renunciant practices to kind of balance those things out. If one's just like really scattered, you use the body, you use the breath. If you're working with a lot of emotional upheavals, use the body and the breath. Inquiry practices then are then using that stillness and composure of mind to really investigate the teaching. So you investigate like Four Noble Truths or like suffering. So if you're pretty centered in your practice and you're feeling like some kind of discontent, you're on your zafu now, and you're there, and you're feeling discontent. You go right to that. You inquire into the feeling of discontent, and those are very powerful, because the root of discontent is also the place of freedom from discontent. And you just go to that and just feel that, your mind gets liberated from that. And those are like inquiry practices. You're really going into some aspect of consciousness. And inquiry isn't just intellectual. It's not, why am I discontent now? I wonder what I did yesterday. It's not that. It's silent, kind of looking, observing. Or you might inquire into the very sense of self. I mean, it's very profound, that. The whole sense of being. You know, who the hell am I? What is this about? And who's trying to get enlightened anyway? And all these kind of questions you get. And these take a lot of silence. Inquiry practices around, like, the characteristics of being, change. You take that one. But that which arises ceases, and you watch that for an hour. That's difficult to do. You just watch change. What happens when you watch change, if you make that a theme? For a half an hour now, I'm just going to watch sound. I'm going to witness the sound, and I'm going to watch how sound changes. Now, to do that, you need a lot of presence of mind. But if you actually do that, what happens? That takes you into a sense of objective knowing, which is very silent and very centered, because you're not reacting to the sound. You're using sound as the object. It's changing, and you're watching change, rather than taking a sound. Oh, I like that. I don't like that. You're not getting caught in the pleasure principle. And as your mind just holds that, your mind comes to stillness because you watch change. You might do that with the body, whatever. You might watch something like just the very sense of self. That's a very important one. Sense of being a person, what's that? And these kinds of inquiries take a lot of presence, a lot of silence, and usually they're done after you've gotten the mind a bit composed. Yeah? Usually that comes up on retreats more. I think in daily life meditation is sort of maintenance work, isn't it? Just get your half hour in. But hopefully that these kinds of suggestions should begin to click, you know, because if you can meditate like a little bit each day, then all that power of patience, determination, endurance, all that begins to be function in your mind. Your mind has all these strengths. It's not sort of just separate from life. So that's a whole lot of topics which to choose. Basically, I think some ways to open the heart, know the body, and I think, you know how to inquire. You have, you know, the kind of basic things like that, and you've got some really good tools. And then the inquiry should be going on all the time. You know, it should be a second level of consciousness, which is functioning after a while. Not that you're always just self-concerned. It's just a self-inquiry, which is just noticing what's happening, and that's lovely. You just begin to understand yourself more and more. All right. Any questions around all of that? Yeah.
In Buddhism and in other traditions, one often comes across this idea that people have different tendencies. Like I might really need to do a certain kind of meditation, but because I have a certain tendency, I'll gravitate towards another one.
Yeah.
And you know, I could spend my whole life not doing the meditation that I really need.
Very true. So, the way that works is the very critical person does meditations on death. You know, they you know, you try to get a really critical person to do practice of the heart. Yeah, smarmy. So they do. Oh, I want to do death. So, but get a person who is really kind of fun loving, and you know, bon vivant. They do lots of metta practice. Oh, may all beings be well. They don't want to do death. It's classic. I've never seen it. Monks and nuns. So the really dour, critical person doesn't want to open their heart. And they go to something that's easier. So, I mean, how do you balance that? Usually it just doesn't work. You know, you get to a place where you realize, you know, you're not really getting anywhere with this. Or you have a teacher who talks, you know, that's the best. There's probably a teacher trying to listens and listens and listens and listens and listens and listens and listens. And listens. I said, oh, maybe. Why don't you try that? That kind of thing. So in the text, they talk about like the critical person, the person with a lot of dosa, to do lots of metta practice. The person with a lot of anger to do practices of loving kindness. And the person who's very sensual, you know, very sensual, to do reflections on death or rotting corpses, literally. And the person who is very doubtful, very, very doubtful, they say reflect a lot on the qualities of the Buddha. The person who's very, very doubtful also to study more, to really get the intellect down, to understand the intellect. So that, yeah, you can. You can just sort of, I suppose, just trip out and have a good time and not really address the things. Any, is that?
Yeah, I mean, I come across this a lot in different places, that you need a guru or you need a teacher, because if you're meditating on your own, you know, this is the problem, that you're going to choose a meditation that feels good or that you like, and that it might not be what you need.
But a lot of people are pretty smart. They also, you know, they have a lot of sincerity. And I met some incredibly creative meditators, you know, who just, they have a kind of integrity about, they really want to work on some area, you know, so they're not, I mean, I met one brilliant woman. She was a sculptor, and she was having a hard time with her husband, right? And just going through whatever. So she visualized a canvas. And on this canvas, she threw out all the stuff she had against her husband in her mind. She got it all out for 20 minutes. And then she visualized it going to the moon. She's an artist, you know, so you do that. It's brilliant, brilliant kind of meditation. But I think the litmus test is, does it work? Does it really, you know, why are we here? We're here to be happy in some, hopefully, more and more profound way. And if it's not working, then we're gonna go back to the drawing board. But having said that, I know, I mean, there's just some stuff that's come up in my life. It's taken a long time to get to terms with it. Some of the karma we have is really very, very deep. So you have to be very persistent. That's one big thing. What you'll find, like in terms of meditations, is you find also a tendency to just kind of do it for a little bit. That'll be one problem. Where you pick up a meditation, you know, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I'll try that. Yeah. And you do it, and because you're interested, it'll work for the first two times, and then it won't work, and then you go, oh, that one doesn't work. And you know, and then you, that's a nice one. I'll try that one. And basically the mind is just playing around with interest. It's not really working with the deeper stuff. Whereas if you take one meditation like the breath, and then you work with it when you feel lousy, when you feel tired, when you feel restless, then, you know, there's a lot of profundity in that. So part of maybe the problem is just a sort of dilettante kind of stuff around meditation. You really have to work at it, like one instrument, I think, for long periods of time. All right? Peter?
What's the meditative angle for anxiety?
Well, I've used two things. I've used a lot of heart practices and body awareness, right? So I've just gotten more and more in touch with that in the body, and anxiety really here, and learned how to really go to the root of it before I conceptualize it or try to do some, really, where is this? Where is this coming from? I mean, that's later in the piece. Early in the piece, it was just survival. So if I, you know, if I had to give a talk, I'd have this, you know, anxiety, panic things, and then I just would basically get the attention in the body and kind of just be aware. So body awareness. And then that becomes more and more subtle for me. And then lots of metta practice, because metta breaks down the alienation I have with others. You know, if I walk along that street and say, may you enjoy your SUV, and then later on I'm walking and feeling self-conscious, that self-consciousness won't be as strong, because actually I've really wished them well. And they're kind of a friend to me now. I mean, I got to be careful. I get too gushing, and then you know, the guy wants to convert me. Really, I have to be careful. but that really breaks down. You know, like if you're going to give a talk or whatever, really just kind of say, I really want to offer something beautiful to these people, or you know, whatever way you can do it. That you know, fear will still be there, but your whole attitude will be not one of that they're threatening you, but they're brothers and sisters. And the more you do that in a background situation where that doesn't come up, the more that relationship to the other people gets strengthened. There. Any others? Yes? Destructive emotions.
That's right.
It's very technical. I'm kind of getting it into now. I think people get pretty bored with this, but I enjoy. You know, I enjoy his, some of the things he comes up with are just stunning. Like what he's saying is that the scientists say there's only brain. And he's saying, no, mind is mind and brain. And then the latest bit, they said, would you say that all mind states have a brain correlate? He said, yeah, all except one. Pure awareness, because that's luminous and that's not—it's not conditioned. It's not physically based, and that's just—I mean, these scientists, I think, are just gaga, because they don't have any—they don't have a paradigm to deal with that, because they're just dealing with a physical paradigm, and he just keeps throwing this kind of whole different model, and in a very scientific way too. It's really stunning kind of analysis. What else? Anything else? Have we done it? All right. Thanks for your attention. Shall we finish with a chant as we do?